I say all that to lead into this, which is one of the biggest problems before these statistics even came out. In my own church, we were worried about youth ministry because we noticed that a lot of our kids were very active and excited about youth ministry, did great stuff, all kinds of wonderful events, and then they graduated and then they left the church. And that's just devastating. I mean, I'm a father of four. I want my kids to stay in church. I mean, I want more than that, but I need at least that, you know. So we have these wonderful youth ministries. They're very well funded. They got great youth ministers, and yet they're dropping out. So, well, my church on the campus, University of Alabama, we've got a campus minister. So I asked the campus minister, hey, we've got youth ministers. He said, well, our best and most active leaders come from churches without youth ministers. Those little country churches we look down on, they at least teach their kids to be committed. Well, that's interesting. Then we had another progressive church in state that had 20 kids graduate, all going to the University of Alabama. Big church. Their youth minister calls our campus minister, they make introductions, we invite them to late days over summer to get them involved and all that. Zero showed. Zero. So we called the other churches in town. Zero. The preacher from that other church came, knocked on their doors in the dorms. Why aren't you going to church? Zero showed. Great youth ministry. Probably had a $50,000 a year budget. Wonderful youth ministry. Zero. And we're the progressives. We do things right. We believe in grace. Something's wrong. So we've been studying on it. We've talked to some experts, read books. This is where we are. Number one. All ministry has to be filtered through the nature, character, and person of Jesus Christ. Right? But what do we need to be teaching our children? To be like Jesus. And to be like Jesus, they must become what kind of people? Servants. Who has the biggest influence on your children? You do. All studies show parents have the biggest influence. May not choose to exercise it, but they have it. Youth minister might have the kids 2 or 3 hours a week on average at best. Parents got them all rest of the time. Whose values are going to be instilled in those kids' emotions? Parents. That's really discouraging.
I see a couple problems that we deal with, and probably it's, we took a consensus of all the congregations, it's probably, we're probably pretty much in agreement, and one is you have a very small number of carrying, even willing to carry some of the load of the work that goes on, and then you have some families or some individuals that are happy just to be lifetime guest. In other words, they want to come there and provide entertainment. They don't want to get too involved because that's going to be requiring them to give up a little bit of time and effort and to get involved. And that's a problem to, a problem is to inspire them to go beyond that because they'll let you know that they're pretty happy where they are and doing what they're doing. And they're pretty content with that. And that's one of the problems you're talking about.
Yeah.
Youth that you're addressing here is the involvement or the commitment to become involved and become committed to each other. It's so easy to sit back and be a guest. That's easy because you can come and go as you want and you don't put on yourself the responsibility.
Well, they're becoming like their parents except less hypocritical about it.
Yeah.
Right. So the parents say, I'm a Christian, go to church, don't act like a Christian. The kids go, they know us better than we know ourselves. They know your weak points, they know your limits, and they know you're not walking the walk, and they follow the example of, well, if I'm not going to walk the walk, why should I bother to give up something?
Right. Yeah, a while ago you mentioned the idea of smaller congregations where kids actually let go to college and actually stay to a degree more faithful than larger congregations. Mike and I shared with a congregation of about 100.
Yeah.
And I had worked with congregations, larger congregations, 400, 450. And I can tell you, and from my own experience, what I believe part of that is, when you have a congregation of 400, 450, and I think it's exactly what we've been said here, a lot of times kids show up. There are youth activities for kids, but they are activities, you know, to entertain them to a certain degree. Not that all Bible studies and anything, but for the most part. With the congregation that Mike and I shepherd, our teenagers aren't spectators. Our teenagers wait on table, lead singing, do announcements, lead opening and closing prayer. Our vacation Bible school.
Kids have to put that up.
When we do vacation Bible school, our teenagers teach the classes.
Yeah.
We have one adult in each class to be just as a supervisor, you know, it's like a supervisor. If they don't do it, fine. The kids do. When our kids graduate from high school, they don't leave school thinking, well, how do I serve? What can I do? They know what they need.
Yeah. Well, we big churches, I mean, my church is about 600 people, we're big churches. What we've been guilty of is treating the kids as consumers. Right? So we want to appeal to them with pizza and parties. But we're not teaching them responsibility and commitment. Now, let me add to that.
All right. Where are you going to get your next elders?
Where am I going to get them? Oh, yeah, that's the try. Got to keep them first.
Don't train them coming out of high school and into college. They will lose interest.
Right. Yeah, we're waiting way too late. And in order to sell to them as marketers, we're making it low threshold, easy, and cheap. And that's the kind of Christianity they learn. Two or three things we need to do to fix that. What you gave is one of them. Really critical is get them involved in leadership at their own level. We need to... Anybody familiar with what's called an orange concept? Really? All right. There's a book. Reggie McNeil wrote it called Think Orange. You'll easily find it on the bookshelf. It's bright, garish orange. You skip the first 160 pages. The last few chapters that matter. It comes out of Andy Stanley's church in Atlanta, the Baptist church, one of the biggest in the country. What they're doing is this. They're saying, rather than the church and youth ministers becoming surrogate parents, taking the kids off the parents' hands, what we're going to do is walk alongside the parents and coach them to be good Christian parents to their children. And we started in the children's ministry. We got a great children's minister, and those parents who've been in it for a few years, they should do it first. Those parents are used to being... Here's your debugs to lead at home with your kids. Here are some things to do with your kids. Here's how to talk about the class with your kids. Here are some events you can come to with your kids. And by the time they get to the sixth grade, they have spent time with their kids praying and talking about Jesus and sharing their faith with their kids. Rather than making it easy for them to not be Christians, we tell them, you're the parents. We're not going to do your job for you, but we're going to help you every way we possibly can. And when you got problems and questions, come to us, we'll help you. We'll coach you. That's now working its way into our teenage program. And the parents have been used to this. You know, it's a change. That's called orange. And Red Book, if you talk to children's ministers and youth ministers, they know all about it. It hasn't really got caught up in church in general. You have to realize, from Alabama, say good things about the color orange. Very hard for me. I'm going to explain how we take an orange and made it bigger. We will not call it big orange. That's somebody else. We don't do that. To give you an example, a couple of years ago, our kids did something called a 30-hour fast. Anybody ever kids do 30-hour family? That couple? They fast 30 hours. Take the savings and use it to feed 100 kids in Africa or some other impoverished area. And it ends with a big event. Come together for dinner, celebrate. Parents are involved. What do you suppose parents do in a 30-hour fast? 30-hour fast? They cook the meal at the end. And they drive the kids to church. They accommodate the kids. Okay? Do they fast? No. In fact, if you read the literature on the 30-hour fast, it says your parents participate, it says yes, they can help cook. If the kids do a 30-hour fast, what do they learn? Well, they learn that we should care about the poor and hungry. We should be willing to sacrifice for the poor and hungry. Right? And they learn that the parents are deeply concerned about their own kids. How much are the parents concerned about the poor and hungry? Well, so far as they can see, none. So the parents' involvement has been to take care of their own kids. They didn't fast. What do they learn about the congregation as a whole? Well, if the church provides a youth minister and cares about their children and willing to tolerate these weird things the youth minister wants them to do, but if the church doesn't care enough to skip a meal for the poor in Africa. Now, had we done that as a congregation, what would that have learned? In other words, my parents had no idea. My parents have a heart. They care about African history. They're willing to sacrifice. They want to skip a meal. That old man down there, he did it too. I guess this is how Christians act. Church is about sacrificing for other people, as opposed to we youth are going to learn to sacrifice for other people and look down our noses at the adults who won't participate. Because what we've taught, notice this, if you look at the statistics, there's this huge dropout rate among youth, but a lot of them come back when they have kids. Why would parents come back when they have kids but not when they don't have kids? Well, because church is good for kids, but not for adults. How did they learn that? Well, because we taught them that. Right? We had these great events that were great for kids, and the parents served pizza for their kids. So what parents are about is their kids, which is true of pagans as well. We're going to do a congregation-wide mission trip. Let me tell you, this is the same sort of thing. For years, we've done short-term missions for teens. Teens would all get on the bus, ride to the airport, go to Guatemala someplace, paint some houses, meet some folks, come back, tell wonderful stories about the life lessons they had learned. Well, we saw poverty like we've never seen poverty. I learned so much. Thank you for sending me. Very powerful impact on kids. Parents went in order to drive the bus, cook the meals, lead devos, maybe. Youth minister probably did that. So I always make sure you had just enough parents to herd kids. But they did not paint the houses. They weren't there for the Guatemalans. They were there for their own kids. What lesson do we teach? Well, it's good to learn to love one of them, but if you're an adult, you really should be about your own kids. Mission is what teens do, not adults. Your parents love you enough to go to Guatemala and cook you burgers for lunch. But they don't love Guatemalans. That's what we teach. So this year, we're redone. We're having multi-generational missions going to Nassau. And the adults are going whether they are parents or not. And the deal is, if not a single teenager signs up, we're going to Nassau. Because the people, the Bahamians, need us. We've contacted Church of Bahamas. There's a great Church of Christ there. Those ministers, I know them personally. Great guy. They do a great thing. They begged us to come help. We're going because they ask us to go. And if all we get are a bunch of 50-year-olds with no kids, praise God. We're going for the Bahamians. But we're going to do VBS type events, and the kids will be great at that. We're going to do some service projects that the kids will be great at. And we're inviting them to go along too to help us adults do missions. So what lesson do the kids learn? That the adults at the University Church of Christ love convenience. In fact, we may take trips in the Palm Springs without the kids, but they'll be in school. But if they need us, we're going to pack our bags and go. And we'll take care of the kids. We're going to have D-boats. And they'll participate, but when they're doing DBS, it'll be DBS adults with the kids helping, being coached and mentored by the adults. But it's not about the kids. When we get through and evaluate the success of the mission, it won't be, will the kids learn valuable, do the kids learn valuable lessons? That's not the point. That's self-centered. But the point of the trip is, did we help the Bahamians as much as we could have? Did we convert people to Jesus? Did we show the love of Christ across international and racial borders, barriers? Do we help our kids see that we're helping this black congregation, desperately poor people? But it's not about the kids. Can't cut the kids out. They're believers too. They're Christians too. They need to be part of it. They can help. They can help with the other kids that we're going to be at that church. We want the Bahamian kids to see our kids, and we hope they'll be good examples. Although it may be the other way around, you know. We want them to learn to appreciate and love people across the board, but we want them to do it because the adults are there. Does that make sense? That is, at least it, for us, is a huge paradigm shift. It is not how we have done youth ministry. Yep.
What was it that Paul said? Be followers of me as I am of Christ?
Yes. So, we're taking that concept and trying to do it church-wide at every opportunity. And our poor youth minister is a wonderful guy, and our Cam Smith is a wonderful guy, and our children's minister is a delightful woman. They're having to learn it as we go, except they actually understand it better than us old folks, okay? But the question is, we sit at the table with our ministers and the elders, and somebody says, what we've traditionally done in youth ministry, camp ministry, is we silo them. We turn them into sub-congregations. They got their own pastor, they got their own worship service, they got their own everything. This happened to share some real estate in the budget. We're saying, guys, no silos, one church. Therefore, when you plan a youth ministry event, ask, could children be part of that? Could campus be part of that? Could the adults be part of that? And if they're not, give us a good reason why not. But we think the default position is, we're together. Doesn't mean you never do them apart. Sometimes they need to have their own social events that are separate. I'm totally cool with that. It's not absolute. But particularly when you do ministry, break down the barriers. So right now, our young marriage class is meeting with our campus class together. 10 years age difference apart, one got kids, one doesn't. But they're teaching and learning from each other to break down that barrier. And we're just looking for opportunities as we plan events to do it together. Our college students came in and said, we want to, we're very concerned about the slave trade in this world. Something that's a real big issue among young people today, and for good reason. Not something you hear about much on the adult pulpit. And they said, well, we're going to do like a 5K run to raise the funds for that. And the reaction of the leadership was, at least credit for a lot of this, was to say, look, why don't we do that as a church? A lot of us too old to run 5K. Some of us could walk 5K. But enough of us can be there that we can have a celebration together. We can raise the money together. Why should it be a campus event? Why can't it be a church event? A lot of the old folks are going, slave trade, what's that got to do with Christianity? Good for them. They're going to learn something. They're going to learn it from our college kids. They're going to go kicking and screaming. But the more time they spend together, the more they will love each other. In reality, not just in theory. And the more they love each other, the more they'll listen to each other. Yeah, this is true of my church. I'm being recorded. I know I'm going to get in trouble for this. Who are your most spiritually immature members? Your youngest or your oldest adults?
Oldest.
We got that same problem. The elders, we've been through different Bible classes over time. I was just talking about church and vision and such. And we met with some groups that were so spiritually rich and deep. It just, you walk out there, want to cry for joy. It's just so wonderful. And the older members, we asked them this question. If you were to leave town and come back in 10 years, and the Holy Spirit had had his way with this church, what differences would you see? And the younger people are saying, well, we'd be more racially diverse. We'd really have gone to campus. We would have saved a lot more souls. Old member said, I kid you not, we'd have the hymn books back. Nobody was going to show up and check your stuff. And we'd be singing the old songs. How have we managed as leaders to take people who are in their 70s and 80s who have walked with Jesus for nearly a century and turn them into some of the most selfish, self-centered, narcissistic members of our congregation? But it's an indictment of me. This is my church I'm talking about. Something deeply wrong with how we do church.
Is it how we do church or just adult attitude that I have reached my plateau and I'm happy?
No, I think it's how they got raised. I think it's how they got brought up. Because I don't, among people, you can kind of see a line in my church, there's an age line. But they don't, they get more mature as they get older. And then they start dropping down. But it's, and there's some of that, which is, I pay my dues, I've got a lot invested in this church. In fact, got time to say this real quick. One of the great sins in all of Christianity is coveting power. Right? And if you're an elder, you have wrestled with people fighting over power. It's my belief that every church split here has not been about doctrine or who the preacher is or what color the foyer is. It's about power. Right? When's the last time you heard a sermon against coveting power? Never. It's not in the book. It's in the book. It's not in our thinking. It's not in the historical practices of the church to talk about that. And yet, one of the biggest sins that holds us back is this desire for power.
I think one of the problems we make, too, is that we sometimes confuse maturity, spiritual maturity, with maturity of age. Just because someone has went to church for 25 or 30 years and is older in years doesn't necessarily mean that they're spiritually mature.
Yeah. Oh, not only that, it seems to be backwards. That we let our older members become more selfish. Here, from a leadership standpoint, I'm preaching to myself on this, all right? I don't know y'all that well. I can't criticize you personally. I don't know. Me. Older member comes up to me. I was taught to respect my elders, meaning older people. And they're upset about something. I try to treat them with great deference and respect. But the reality is, if what they're trying to do is use raw power to influence the direction of the church, they're sinners. If you go back to Jesus' 40-day fast in the wilderness, what did Satan tempt him with? Power. That's one of the first three temptations Satan tried. Why? Power. Well, because it's one of the most tempting things to a deity, you think. So we've got to, as leaders, be willing, and I've got to have the courage to say to people, look, you can't do that. I can't keep you from withholding your contribution. I can't keep you from leading. I can't keep you from talking bad. But it's wrong. That is sin. You have to submit to the body. Submission to the body is taught throughout the New Testament. A lot of people don't like hearing that because they got burned by elders in the past. Got burned by bad church leadership. And the idea of submitting to church leadership to them is just anathema because they have bad experiences. But you can't be a good leader without people being willing to submit. Submission has to be taught, not negotiated. And when people use selfish methods to get their way, make threats, act like little three-year-olds, we can't condone it. We can't put up with it. We have to say that. That is law. And I think, in fairness to them, though, you don't do that the first time ever in the hall. I think you start preaching it. It needs to be a part of our standard teaching. Think about this. I got two churches, Church A and Church B. Church A is a church plant. It's only been around about 5 years. It's got 100 members. It's got a preacher. They rent their space. Members are all relatively new converts, most of them less than 5 years. There's some other folks who transferred in, but mainly it's made up of new converts. And they only got 100 members, they got a preacher, they only own a building, and they don't make budget. Got another church, Church B. They've been around, they got 100 members. They got a preacher. They paid for their building, they got money in the bank. Their members have been Christians all their lives, average age in the 40s. Which church is going to reach 200 first? The young one. But the one that's got money and experience is being held back. Why? Does it help to be poor and naive? What's the difference? Why don't experience and money help you do better instead of they hold you back?
Because they become set in their ways and comfortable.
Yeah. They become selfish.
My dad used to tell me the only difference between a rut and a grave is the depth of the hole.
That's true. So we have taught a brand of Christianity that condones despising mission in preference to making yourself happy. So you go to the old church and say, guys, we've got to be about Jesus. We've got to be about the mission. We've got to seek and save the lost. We've got to do these things. We've got to pay the price. And they say, not if you got a change in unity, though. Right, that does not come from doctrine. Right? We hear doctrine. That's not about doctrine. That is about selfishness and power. Right? You can sing new songs instead of old songs and not violate any biblical principle. I don't care how conservative you are. Right? It's selfishness. And until we start calling sin, sin, and selfishness, selfishness, and what we're going to have are a bunch of 100-member churches. In fact, the average size church is the Church of Christ, between 75 and 100. So tell me we're teaching pure theology and really teaching the whole counsel of God. No, we're not. But we're putting up with sin, treating it as holy because they express it in doctrinal terms. But it's, in fact, profoundly selfish, narcissistic, sinful, holding back the kingdom. In fact, it's destroying the churches of Christ. But even in the more race-centered, Christ-centered, progressive congregations we have, right? We don't preach against it like we should. We don't see it as wrong because we don't have a picture, this is going back to the first lesson, that all goes together, of what it is to be a Christian, meaning it is to be like Jesus, meaning it's all about sacrificing and submitting, being accountable. How many lessons do we have on accountability, mutual accountability? Is that biblical that we should be accountable to one another?
Absolutely.
Profoundly. If you were to say to your church, you need to be accountable to the elders, what would your church say? Yeah. Right? People don't want to be accountable. They don't want to be submissive. They want to be, just like our congregations, they want to be autonomous.
We've taught, society as a whole has taught Christianity that we go to church to worship.
Yep.
And we have been programmed that that's the way we worship God, is we worship God in the five acts you spoke about in so many of your lessons. And regardless of whether they use those exact five acts or whatever routine takes place at the church, that is worship. And what we need to replace that is our lives are supposed to be worship. And the only reason we're ever supposed to come together as a group is to edify and build each other up. That is not worship. That's for us.
Is it? Y'all know that. That's how you got to be elders. People see that in you. Every time I meet with elders, I love meeting with elders. I just love them. you see this heart, this passion for people, they'll understand it.
Right.
But we don't get it down to the flock. And I mean, just imagine the sermon series. Talk about mutual submission, mutual accountability. My church, a lot of people have joined what are called accountability groups. Y'all familiar with accountability groups? It's like groups of three, four people. Meet together weekly and you talk. How was your Christian walk this week? And when you study the scriptures, it is pointed and personal and all about you. That's why it's got to be such a small group, because you got to be willing to share the nastiness. You know, I struggle with porn, or I struggle with this, and I snapped at my kids, and I don't know how to not snap at my kids. You know? Well, you can't share that in a small group setting at 15. So, best friends, three to four people, covenant, to be confidential, and help each other make it. You know? That's the essence of Christianity, that many of our members of churches, that is as foreign as I can be talking Russian. Right? So we're, the denomination Church of the Christ is not important. Christianity, Christ, all important. Okay? We're not going to make it on behalf of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ unless we're able to effectively call our members into submission. Not to me, but to their Lord. And more importantly, or as importantly, to each other. Because you can't be in submission to Jesus if you're not in submission to one another. Right? If we can do that, though, it changes. In that 100-member church that won't grow, well, all the barriers go away. All you have to do is eliminate the selfishness. Now, I make it sound easy. It's not easy, but it's incredibly difficult. You're asking for a culture shift. Change in what religion is, what Christianity is, what a relationship with Christ is. But absent that, that church dies. So if it closes the doors even quicker because you preach an unprofitable sermon, an unpleasant sermon, fine, it was going to die anyway.
If it died like that, maybe some of the members that couldn't go there anymore would find some place to go. They'd learn something.
I've seen it. Have you seen that? Somebody gets so mad, so selfish, can't stand it, can't stand not getting their way, so they leave and go somewhere else. Right? Well, at the old church, they thought they had power. When they got confronted and found out, oh, we don't have power, they got mad and left. They go to another church, they know they don't have power. And guess what? They blow up. We had a couple that came from a very legalistic background. I loved them to death as individuals, but they just could not get over it. Things like clapping in church and all kinds of things. They just could not get over it. And we did some things they couldn't stand, and they got furious. I mean, just red-faced, angry, and they left. They went to the First Wesleyan Church. They're in the choir. What changed? Did their theology change? Well, in a sense, rather than being about Christianity, it's about me being in church to make sure that everything is right. They failed. They had to go somewhere else, but at least loyal enough to Christ to go somewhere. And they got re-educated by being humble. I don't think they even know they were humble. You know, it just happened. Sometimes people have to leave in order to grow up. All right, we'll take 10-minute break, and cards, questions. Please turn in your cards so we can talk the last session about all your questions. I only got one question.
That's because you did such a thorough job.
That is unimaginable. It's not like that's the only stuff I know about. You know, I can't answer everything. It's a wide range of topics.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't know, I can fail. I've heard the concept promoted that elders in early Gentile churches took on a different role approach than those in more Jewish congregations. Any comments? I have not heard that, and I'll give you what that may be referring to, which is the synagogues had elders. So a So if a Jewish congregation began a synagogue, then there would be an element of truth. I study the term elder. And where does the term overseer, where's the term elder, where's the term shepherd come from? Well, shepherd clearly comes, I think, from Ezekiel 34. God being the shepherd of Israel. And then Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd, claiming to be God, right? Say, I'm the good shepherd, if you got one. And then scriptures refer to the leadership as shepherds. We're under shepherds in the nature of Christ and God as shepherds, which is kind of an awesome, staggering thought. Overseer is a Gentile word, it's a Greek word, referring to middle management. We would translate supervisor just about as well. But it refers to somebody with positional authority, but on behalf of someone else. Elder goes back to the leaders of the tribes of Israel, then ultimately the leaders of the cities, the towns, each had elders. They sat at the gate and acted as legislators, not making new laws so much. They acted as judges. If there was a dispute, they would resolve the dispute, which is why later when Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 talks about, the elders need to go to court. Can't you make your own judgments? Well, an elder and him, that's what they did. But they also sat by the city gates to decide who got to come in. Because if you say, you're a merchant, you're coming from Bethany, you cheated our people last year, you can't come in. Right? We don't trust you. So the elders were the gatekeepers. And they represented people to the king. It was the elders who named David as king, long after God had. But when David finally, when Saul was dead, the elders anointed David again as king. So they had some kind of authority. Now, when the Jews went to exile, all that ended. And so the synagogues became a Jewish community within a larger Gentile community. And the synagogues were like a community center. They were headed by elders. They weren't leaders of the synagogue building, or even the congregation who meets at the synagogue on First Street. But they were the leaders of the Jewish city within the larger city. That's how they would have thought of it. So it just struck me, just really crazy one time, reading through Acts, there are two kinds of elders, the Jewish elders, who are the bad guys. The elders are always out after the Christians. And then Paul's talking about these wonderful people called elders. Why would you name your leaders after your enemies? Unless there was something about that structure you were trying to preserve. But one of the really profound New Testament teachings is that we are a community. We're citizens of heaven. Right? Our nationality is not American, it is Christian. And who are the leaders within our city? Well, the church is the polis, it's the city in that city, within the city. And the elders are the leaders. All the things we talk about, elders do. But that's the continuation of the idea. So the elders of the synagogue, they were about caring for that community of Jews within the community of Babylonians or community of Armenians or whoever it was. They were the community leaders. And they saw themselves as resident Israel, is a good phrase. And so they had their own form of kind of alternative city government. Not that they were in rebellion against Rome necessarily, but the things that really mattered. Marriage, divorce, community life, religion. The elders were the authority, not the Romans. So that part, I think, got carried over into the church. But in Jerusalem in particular, the elders were also politicians. They were collaborated with Rome, and they loved power. The reason they hated the church is the church was going to overthrow their power. If Jesus is the Messiah, he's the king, then those of us who cut our deal with Rome to have power here, we're going to lose that. So the political side, of course, did not care about it. But never. That was sin. Jesus railed against that. But, the proper side of it. Is. I think there's an element of what church is supposed to be like, how we're supposed to think about church that you see through those backgrounds that you wouldn't otherwise see.
I saw the synagogues because we talk about ruler of the synagogue being one individual.
There was one person who was like the custodian's wrong word.
And ruler Crispus wasn't here.
But one guy who was not quite the preacher or the rabbi, you know, but he was in charge of the institution. So he was subject to the elders, as I understand it. Now, there's a lot about synagogues we don't know. Because mm-hmm. You said it's a bad habit of not writing anything down for a few hundred more years. So, well, there's a lot of history to die with him. But the ruler was not, not like he was the city. He was like the chief official under the elders. So it would be somewhat like a preacher would be for us.
But in the text, the way it's presenting there, it seems to give him all authority in that particular synagogue.
The thing is, this is developed, and this is just from a historical standpoint, is synagogue practice was not uniform. As much as we can tell pretty clearly. It's a man-made institution. It's not governed by the Old Testament or the Torah. So different areas did it differently. You'll find some of the synagogues way west Roman Empire compared to those east Roman Empire are very different. You can't generalize. That may be that in that case you had a guy who was the one man. But in Palestine, in Judea, there were elders over there. But you can't, there's not a standard rule.
I talked to you before we started, but I'd still like to get some of your feedback on how you bring a church. I mean, one of the points you made earlier is a church can't exist that has conservative and, as you say, progressive, liberal, whatever. I mean, it's going to break one way or the other. And our congregation is breaking to, we would say, the progressive side. We've got it's mainly older people who are, are pushing back. And so some of the idea is we've been teaching, Romans, Galatians recently, and we're getting some people saying, it's okay to teach that, but you're choking people on it. And I wish I had thought that, the other piece of that is we got people that are starving for that.
That's right.
Yeah. So do you have any thoughts on how you progress?
That happened in my church. I can tell you kind of our story, but I don't know that it would happen everywhere because we were very blessed with the elders who went before me. Those men were not great teachers, but they were great leaders. In the sense, they were great mission givers. And so there was, in my generation, I've been in charge of adult ed all as long as I've been an adult. And they let me do some things that a lot of churches never let you do. So, for example, for a long time, we've had a policy that we did not have a brother so-and-so class. We rotate teachers. One reason for that is, if you study church splits, they tend to fracture along class lines, Sunday school class lines. If you've got a brother so-and-so class, and he's been teaching a 1940s position for 50 years, then you've got younger brother so-and-so class, and they've learned the more grace-centered gospel, but they don't hear each other. They become separate congregations within a church. So we wanted, before we started teaching them a better gospel, we eliminated that. And we started rotating teachers. And I figured, even if it meant that some of the more legalistic teachers were teaching some of the younger classes, that the truth would out. Ultimately, people would hear what's right and be persuaded. So we're not going to say, you're no longer part of the faculty. Everybody gets to teach. But everybody has to teach, even people who aren't necessarily sympathetic. And it's really healthy because folks have a tendency to assume that everybody agrees with me, I'm just the only one that's got enough guts to speak up. You ever heard that? So when they rotate around the classes, they found out. Class says, we didn't see that in the Bible. Could you show us where that is, please? And very gently sometimes a class will read the teacher and is saying, we're not persuaded we don't see that. At least they'll know that not everybody agrees with them. And that sometimes leads to a little questioning and humility. It's a good thing. But that means all the classes get to hear the good lessons on grace. And of course, some of them just laugh it up and love it, and others are like, I'm scared of this. But at least they've heard it. And then We started teaching classes on grace at my church maybe around 1980, you know. And I got better at it, other people got better at it, we had to learn it as we were teaching it, you know. But repetition, you just got to hear it a lot of times, and then it's got to be reinforced from the pulpit. And, you know, so I pity those churches that have a preacher, for whatever reason they can't get rid of it, wants to hold the church back. Because it's awfully hard to work around the pulpit, because we're trained as the way we do church, that, you know, the preacher is like he's the voice of God, you know. And if you're teaching something else in the classroom from what he's teaching, it undercuts. You know, and you seem like you're in rebellion. Now, we were fortunate, really blessed, that our eldership, you know, allowed that teaching to go on. Sometimes I even come to class and just sit quietly and listen, you know, but I've not once, for all my rebellious ways, have not once been called in on carpet by the elders. And I've taught all kinds of outrageous things.
I'm an elder at the church where I've been since I was four. Just so from a historical perspective, here's Dan, I'd like to respond to this question just a little bit, because sure. I've seen at the congregation I'm at, I think 11 splits in my lifetime.
Wow.
And so I have a unique perspective on some of that, maybe perhaps. You know, we've had peace in our congregation about 20 years now. In my lifetime as eldership, as an elder, we've had a change in leadership that's managed to be able to promote, provide a peaceful, create a more peaceful environment. But the thing I've noticed is that people, fear is a big problem. And so you see people jockeying for power in order to, because they're afraid. They're afraid that if the traditionals get it, then the progressives are going to just, you know, and if it's the other way around, you know,
if you're conservative, you're afraid, I'm going to be part of a church that's going to hell because we are going to do this.
Right. So there's fear that is a big problem. And one of the things that we did in this iteration of our leadership is we started taking people into our homes from both, you know, like the traditional and the progressive and together.
Yep.
And once they got to know each other, found out they both loved the Lord, and that they weren't trying to just, they're getting to know each other helped them to overcome some of those fears. I must say they got rid of all the fears, because there's a lot, and a lot of teaching, a lot of stuff, but one of the problems, like you were talking about those Bible classes being separate like that,
yeah.
You know, if they don't get to know each other, they're afraid of each other. And, by getting rid of some of this fear was a real big help for us promoting trust and peace in our congregation.
That's a very good point. In fact, it reminds me, about 10 years ago, we started clapping to the music. We had some older members that were just outraged. Didn't ask them to clap, you don't have to clap. Not everybody claps. So clap. Our song leader at the time was a young guy, delightful young man, and he taught a Wednesday night class on worship. And that group of people who didn't like it got into there, and they confronted him about he's on clapping. And I was in there, not knowing, I wanted to help her at the time, but I didn't know this was going to come up. I thought it was going to get really ugly. And he said, look, number one, I understand you don't need clapping to feel like worshiping. I do. That's my generation. That's how I personally feel. These songs were written rhythmically. If I'm not clapping, if my whole body's not engaged, I don't get it. And I understand you don't have to feel that way to worship. And I find you're not clapping doesn't bother me at all, but hey, I'm not worshiping if I'm not clapping. And then he said, but you're the song leader. And you're clapping. He said, yeah, but this church has got no rhythm. And if I don't lead, we'll be clapping on three different beats on a two-beat song, you know. And so the only way you can do it and have it be musically acceptable and not be just distracting everybody is for somebody to lead the clapping. If you don't lead the clapping, it's going to be terrible clapping. And they just kind of went back and forth, but the fact that he didn't say, because you're wrong. He just simply said, this is how I feel. Disarmed him. Because he was saying to them what they were saying to him. You know, I don't feel like I'm marching against him, clapping. And he said, well, please don't clap. But please let me clap. And the fact they were able to talk about it that way, that issue died that night. Still not happy about it. It's been 10 years, you know, they're still not happy to clap, but they're happy enough. Nobody left. Nobody in the complaints. I think it's so critical that the central issue in a lot of these church fights is what's the fellowship issue, what's the salvation issue, and that's got to be taught. And you just got to face it square on and go through, this is what Scripture said. And then from there you go to Romans 14 and talk about tolerance.
Everybody plays weak brother, though.
Well, we got that going on right now. I got some weak brothers who are very proud to be with us. You know? And what you have to explain, and they don't want to hear it. They really do not want to hear this, is yes. But you're not allowed to look down on the strong brother. He's not allowed to look down on you. It's a two-way street. You're not allowed to condemn the strong brother. He's not allowed to condemn you. Two-way street. So this conversation cannot proceed from the standpoint of condemnation or looking down our noses at somebody. Now, when you take those off the table, it kind of changes the conversation, which is exactly what Paul meant to do, of course. But those are prohibited. Right? So if you're coming here in judgment, use that. That conversation is not allowed.
I apologize. I don't want to speak too much, but you used Philippians earlier, Philippians chapter 2.
Yes.
That entire book really is dealing with this, what Paul talks about in the first chapter where, you know, he's being, he's in prison. People are using that as an opportunity to make his life miserable when they're preaching the gospel in order to try to make his life miserable. He says he doesn't care how it affects him because it's not about him. It's whether Jesus is being glorified or he's being exalted in his body. And you kind of touched on that. It's really about teaching our people that it's just not about you. It's just not about you, you know.
And you're right. And we've taught that for years. And some people get it.
Yeah.
And other people just
don't.
Do not.
I know. But, part of what we try to do, we really try to drive home this thing. It's just not about you. It's just not. Because the problems are not doctrinal. The people are, you know, they'll wrap it in doctrine in order to justify their bad behavior, but it's just not. It's, you talked about power, you talked about, there are a lot of things it's about. It's about what they want or they don't want, but it's not, not been about doctrine.
Yeah, so one of the insights, it's really led to a lot of insights for me. I got a good friend, Law Parker, who's a deacon in the Baptist Church. And he'll come in and talk about their worship wars. I'm thinking, you got no doctrinal issues, how are you having wars? And he'll describe their fights. And they're our fights. Old music, contemporary music, old hymns, new hymns. It's just they don't doctrinalize them. They're more honest about it. You know, it really is about me. You know, and they have the same problems, same fights, same struggles. For us, it's harder because our people have been trained to make everything about doctrine because that's how you win. And they actually believe it. You know, sometimes you can say, give me book, chapter, and verse, and call it bluff. But other times, you know, not so easy. They really do have scruples. But that's when you got to get into Romans 14. I wish it was that easy because, I mean, we struggle with it. Everybody struggles with it. But that's kind of the patience. Repetition. Teach it. Make sure it comes from the pulpit. And it's perfectly all right for elders to occasionally preach. You know, and I think actually churches like it. You're not too terrible. You can be pretty awful, and the church still like it. Because I remember years ago, our church was between preachers, and the elders filled in the pulpit, and they weren't very good. You know, they just weren't. But they had such hearts for the gospel, for Christ, for the congregation, and as they spoke, you could see that heart in them. And the church responded. We grew with, I mean, nobody would offer any one of them a job as a pulpit preacher. Right? Not qualified. And the church loved it because they loved hearing from their shepherds. Amen. Right? And we're doing, we're between pulpits right now. I've preached twice. I've got other elders that are preaching. And interestingly enough, you know, some of the guys are not particularly articulate. They struggle. They don't like being up front. But when they get up front, they pour their hearts out. And the church just laps it up. And I keep wondering, every time this happens, I say the same thing, is why do we only let the preacher preach? We need the elders to be up front more often. So when that happens, the elders can do what we're supposed to do, which is we're supposed to admonish and rebuke and get rid of false doctrine. That's our jobs. You don't have to preach every Sunday to do that, but every once in a while, church will respond, I think, 100 times better if an elder stands up and says, look, we've been talking as an eldership. We are worried sick over this problem. This is how we see it. And if it's the pulpit guys, like, yeah, we're paying you. Who are you to tell me? You're my employee. It's terrible that people think that way about our preachers, but they do. But elders, it's just different. You don't want to overdo it. But I think, and to a degree, particularly on big issues like that, do yourself.
Have you ever read Alexander Scroft's book, Biblical Eldership?
Parts of it. I didn't make it all the way through it.
You know, he makes a good point about, you know, he's all for plural eldership.
Yes.
And of course, coming from, I guess, the Presbyterian aspect of it, he, you know, he includes the preacher as being, you know, an elder, part of their elders, you know, right. A pastor. And reading that book, it seemed to me like he made a lot of sense to me about, you know, of course, a group of men having different gifts, being able to do different jobs, and having one of them to be, you know, gifted preacher.
Yeah.
I think, to me, that makes more sense.
There are churches of Christ that are now routinely naming their pulpit guy as an elder. Sometimes that's difficult because of the age and parents and such. But what we're going through a preacher search right now. What we're telling our preacher, and we learned this from John Salvin, Charles' son. He taught at Elder Lincoln Atlanta this a couple of 3 years ago. He said, look, he's a young guy, probably about 30s. He said, I was talking to our elders about how to organize, you know, kind of the hierarchy, the organizational structure of the church. Where does the preacher fit as along the elders? And historically, we've done a kind of a corporate board CEO kind of structure. He said, look, my job involves teaching the gospel to the members. The elders teach the gospel to the members. My job involves caring for people sick and hurting, going to the hospital, funerals, comforting people in loss. The elders do exactly that. He goes through a list of about 5 things. He says, my job description and the elders' job description is essentially the same. So what we do, he said, is we act as co-leaders. So my church would not stand for naming the preacher as an official elder. But what we are doing, and I have no hesitancy in telling the church knows this, is we make him into a quasi-elder. He meets with the elders on everything other than his salaries and benefits and job duties. Okay? He's in the meetings, he's a full participant. We don't take votes, so he gets the same vote the rest of us gets. Right? We run by consensus. So the question of whether he's a voting member or not is utterly moot. But we want him to be a part of that process. And as we review the other staff members, we want him to see how we do it so he knows we're being fair. Or if we're not being fair, he can tell us we're not being fair. Because we want the staff to be able to say, want him to be able to tell the staff, yeah, this was a right and wise and kind and gracious decision. You just don't know all the facts, perhaps. And so when we talk about members, we're talking with the preacher. When we're talking about church vision, we're talking with the preacher. We're doing all that together. And then we'll meet with the entire staff regularly as well. So what we're telling guys, we have a team model of leadership. Which is, and the preacher's part of the team. So he's not under the elders, not over the elders, not beside the elders. He's in amongst the elders and all the mess with us. And we want to be, with the mess he's handling, we want to be walking alongside him, helping him too. So that you don't have, in another church in my hometown, There's a preacher I talked to, he's nearly in tears when he told me this. He said, I can't meet the elders unless I write them a letter and ask to be on the agenda.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
You know, and I'm saying, no, we would have to, you know, we can't do our job with the preacher not being part of it. We can't be pursuing two separate agendas. You have to have an agenda, which means we have to have built the agenda together. And to the extent we can, we include the whole staff. When I first became an elder, we were not very close to the staff. We worked very hard to get close to the staff. It is so much more pleasant. You do such a better job, and the congregation will thrive if you've got unity between the elders and the staff. That which means you've got to be one. And there is no way to become one with somebody except to spend time together. But we started having a weekly lunch meeting with staff. And at first, they didn't like coming. They had a tendency for their meetings to run late. Oh, I forgot I scheduled something on top of this. My mistake. Well, it's every Wednesday. How could you forget? You know, you have this passive-aggressive behavior. Because they didn't want us in their business. But as we've gone to the multi-generational model we talked about in the last hour, and as we have done team-building exercises, which I'll tell you about in just a second, and as we persuaded them that we, whether you want it or not, we elders are insistent that we're going to work together. Yeah, it's a job. We mean it. We're not manipulating you. It's how we're going to run this church. We're going to run it together. It's become favorite time of the week. I look forward to our elders and staff meetings. Have a good time. Have a lot of laughs. Share some horrible things, cry together, but it's, on the whole, a time of celebrating victory, talking, making plans about things we all love. And I would not want to do it any other way. I wouldn't be an elder if you had to do it some other way. It's miserable. Now, real quick, write this down. The five dysfunctions of a team by Patrick Lencioni. Available on Amazon, costs about $10. The business management book written by somebody who knows more about Christianity than a lot of preachers. Patrick Lencioni, Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Great book. Sheer genius. It is a parable. First two-thirds of the book is a parable about how to function as a team. And then he goes through and breaks the parable down and explains it to those of us who need rules. Talks about building trust, being accountable for your decisions, and all kinds of things. And we got with the elders, and we read it together, we got the staff, and we all read it together, and then we said, all right, staff, we're going to meet together, and you're going to take turns presenting one chapter to us. Tell us what you think. Lead us in discussion. And there's some hard discussion because they would sometimes say, correctly, elders, you may believe in this book, but you're not doing this. We'd have to say, you're right. Sorry. Thanks for pointing that out. We'll try to do that. Of course, that then gives us permission to say, by the way, you got to be honest. And the key to it is a willingness to be honest enough to have conflict and adult enough to resolve the conflict in a way that's healthy. Right? Which means you got to trust somebody to be willing to say, elders, you made this decision, you didn't consult us, and you totally messed up my program for this quarter. How come you didn't ask? And the elders have to be willing to say, because we're clouds that we made a mistake and we're going to try to do better next time. Not get mad and play power politics and try to be prideful. Right? But if you work through that exercise, staff will come to trust you. And you'll value that trust so much you'll try to do anything not to breach it. You'll still mess up, you know how that is, but you do your best. And they'll see you trying and they'll appreciate that. But then you're able to call on them and say, all right, guys, we're not going to be siloed. You're not going to run your youth ministry like a separate church and you're the pastor and you're not accountable to anybody. You're going to coordinate with the children's minister, the campus minister, and the whole adult ministry. We're going to do this together. And rather than him saying, how dare you micromanage my ministry, it is, thank you for your wise counsel. But you want to get there by walking through the process of team building. And that book is the best ever written on the subject. And I would do it the way I just said. I would really decide, I think you'll find it deeply spiritual. It doesn't cite scripture, but the principles behind it are all over the New Testament. And then you take that discipline and walk with the fellow elders, and the elders together ought to do this. I'm very, very, very blessed that the elders I've served with, who've never had these issues, who've always functioned very well as a team, very honest, very openly. They don't mind telling me when they disagree with me. And they're wrong, but we'll talk through it, you know. We can converse, but we had that barrier with the staff. And we've had to work on it for a long time. This is not a weekend, right? This is a multi-year process. Because it requires, we have staff members who've been at churches that were so burned by prior elderships, they just struggled dealing with elders. They love Jesus so much, they love the ministry so much, but they've been burned by elders that trouble trusting elders. And you've got folks who are used to being typical youth ministers. And this is not all of them, but most of them, is I'm going to be, I'm going to run my ministry the way I please. I know what I'm doing. I've been in college, and I had classes. And you know what? When I tell my kids what to do, they do it. So how come you can't tell your adults what to do? Because they're not teenagers. Right? And you got this barrier, cultural barrier, the youth minister barrier. How do you break that down? Form that bond, that team with them, so. And the tendency is we tend to all want to be like, you know, added warriors. We lob grenades over the wall, let the youth minister, and maybe he'll straighten up. It's much better. It's Machiavelli, you know. You have your friends close and your enemies closer. Right? The more distance there is between you and your staff, the more important it is you get them close. The more your philosophy is different, the more important it is you get close. First, you're going to have to fight. And those are your choices. But you can't put up with having somebody at a distance, not part of them. And I'll tell you, I'd rather have a mediocre preacher than a preacher who is a brilliant preacher, but will not be a team player. But, and we discussed that on the front end of hiring, and I always say there are team players, they have great success being team players, and they're not all team players. You know? But we have found that to be extremely helpful for and to study to do with the staff.
All right,
we've got time for one more quick question.
Do you see that we as an organization, the Church of Christ, has taught our members that if we go to, in other words, we're all going to go to heaven together, or we're going to go to hell together, we're not individually accountable in the church.
Yeah.
In other words, my thoughts in that area is that if the church is off base a little bit, but you got your life straight, you may not go to hell with the rest of them.
Yeah.
And, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll put it another way. I think this
yeah,
is the same
okay.
thing. Because we have historically seen our salvation depend on how we do church.
Okay.
That's right. We're all going to go to church together, go to heaven together, not because. Well, if we have a plurality of elders and they've all got a plurality of children, they're all married, we check all the boxes, then we're good with God. We're going to be good together or not. Right? And that attitude pervades a lot of our thinking. So what congregation you join depends on your ultimate faith. And when somebody in that church wants to do something you're not comfortable with, well, your soul's at stake. I was just reading a book, which is also for sale here. It's by the Leafwood Press. It's called Invisible Fellowship. It's two different words, invisible. It is actually kind of like Cliff Notes to Dietrich Bonhoeffer's, what's it called? Not the Cost of Discipleship, is the one that came after that. I should know that. About life together. Okay? At least called life together. Bonhoeffer was a German theologian. During World War II, a brilliant guy, Lutheran, of course, and yet his books are, I mean, you know, and yet he's just a great theologian, great reading. but hard to read because he was German theologian. He said profound things and actually decided it was more important to live a life of love than necessarily even to go to heaven. So that he said, even if God damns me for it, I have to go help the church assassinate it. So he left the United States, went back to Germany. He had fled. Went back to Germany, part of the conspiracy that killed Hitler, which failed, and he died because of it. But he did that knowing he was risking his son in his mind. Okay? His book, Life Together, is about Christian fellowship. And he makes this point, which I've never thought about quite in these terms. He says, look, church is imperfect. It's full of flawed people. And the church is therefore itself flawed. True submission and accountability is your willingness to submit to an institution that you know is flawed. Right? We want to be autonomous. That's the nature of Americans. So we make excuses not to submit. So we look at the flaws in the church and say, well, therefore, I don't have to submit. It's imperfect. But that's not submission. Real submission is dealing with people who are imperfect. Right? If you're all married men, the elders are. You have to submit to your wife, and she has to submit to you. It's a mutual submission. You're not perfect. She's not perfect. Right? It's not submission unless it is. They are imperfect. Right? The fact that the church is imperfect just means that it's the church. And then we still have to submit. And that is a lesson that is utterly foreign to how we think in the Church of Christ. Because we're thinking, when it's perfect, it's earned its way to heaven, and then I can be a part of it. It's good enough for me.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
That's right. But the real thing is, short of the end of time, until the afterlife comes, it's imperfect. It's going to be imperfect. It's always going to be imperfect. And yet we submit. Which elders understand it can do. I mean, people wonder how the elders sit when you're in power. The elder is all about submitting. You're not about getting your way. I don't know. At least in my church, when we talk to the worship leader about worship, there's yet to be a conversation with the elders and say, these are songs I like. We got over that. We got the right, right? We can have our songs and more. We're the elders. It's always, what's best for the mission? What's best for the congregation? Right? And the most selfless people I know are elders because they are the ones who learn to submit. But the church assumes that because you're in power, that you do what they would do in power, which is you use it for your own benefit. Yeah. So that's one reason we need to talk more and more about these kinds of things. Thank you all very much.